Thanks very much, and welcome to all the people who have come in just now, because this lecture, as well as being the last plenary lecture of the Cambridge Neuroscience Seminar, is of course also a public lecture as part of the Cambridge Science Festival, and it is being streamed live on the web, and you can download it afterwards and put it on your iPods or whatever afterwards. So. And it's a good choice of such a lecture for public consumption, because the subject matter is something that is of interest to all of us: how we regulate our diurnal rhythms, how we sense light and interpret it to govern our metabolism and many other things. And also because of the choice of speaker, because Russell Foster is not only one of the world leaders in the field, which is self-evident from the prizes he's received, his election to the Royal Society and so on, but also he's very much engaged in the public understanding of science. He's written a number of popular science books and given many public lectures and involved in science festivals and so on. So he really is the ideal person and the ideal subject to engage everybody, neuroscientists and the general public alike, on a really interesting topic. And you didn't come here to listen to me, you came here to listen to Russell. So Russell, please.
Thank you very much indeed, Robin. Is this microphone is working? Yes? Jolly good. Before I kick off, I'd just like to draw your attention to the British Neuroscience Association. Please go to our website, and I urge you to engage with the organisation, because you'll benefit in lots of exciting and perhaps even unexpected ways. Right, what I'd like to do is, in the next 50 minutes or so, is consider light, clocks and sleep, and really the discovery of a completely new photoreceptor system in the eye. And I suppose the philosophy behind the talk is basic science asking a fundamental question has turned out to really inform some clinical practice. And what I'm going to end with is some discussion of clinical practice in ophthalmology. I'd also like to acknowledge the BBSRC, who funded a lot of the basic science that's been involved in this presentation, and then the Wellcome Trust, who are continuing to fund the basic science, but also critically some of the translational work that I'll talk about at the end, along with the Oxford Biomedical Research Centre. Again, I think a classic example of where a basic research council has provided underpinning science with clinical application, ultimately with clinical application. We're going to cover a lot of ground. What I'd like to kick off with is an introduction to body clocks and sleep, brief introduction, then talk about the discovery of this third receptor system, how we got to it, then consider some of the cells, molecules and mechanisms involved in this new receptor, the fact that, again, our ideas changed, what we thought is of a receptor that was regulating the body clock, and as it's turned out, it's doing a lot more than just regulating internal time. Then consider, most of this work was done on mouse models, the extent to which the mouse studies actually map onto our own species. And then finally, consider some of the issues in ophthalmology and a brief discussion. Now, I understand we don't have time for questions at the end, but what I'd like to sort of encourage you to do is that if I say something stupid or incoherent or you don't understand me in any way, wave. We'll clarify and then go forward. I think it's really important that we sort of build on the understanding. And in fact, somebody's already raised their hand at the back. Is that you, Harry? Yes, I thought it might be. So, my nephew. Ah, there we go. So, let's kick off with introduction to these body clocks. And of course, these 24-hour body clocks, also called circadian rhythms or circadian clocks, and sleep processes generally have captured the popular imagination. In fact, you can't really open a magazine or a newspaper these days without encountering some information about sleep or clocks. And I thought I'd just sort of expose you to some of my pain early on, because sometimes this coverage hasn't been necessarily helpful to the field. And this was an article I wrote some time ago now for the Times Higher. Not basically our work, but it was trying to explain that the body clock of our own species, humans, changes with development. As we go from pre-puberty into puberty and beyond, our timing changes. And in fact, teenagers genuinely have a biological predisposition to get up late and go to bed late. And what this article is all about was saying, well, why don't we just modify the timetable a little bit, have more demanding lectures and subjects, perhaps starting a bit later in the day? Well, I thought it was a perfectly reasoned debate, and the Daily Mail got hold of this, and the title was, Making Teens Start School in the Morning is Cruel, Brain Doctor Claims. That wasn't great, but I went into the lab and somebody said, actually go online, and you can read all of these comments that are coming in. The one that I liked the best was, rather than being a brain expert, this man sounds brain dead. That was my first encounter. Another one was in the Daily Mirror. I'm sure many of you take this this paper. And it was very exciting because Beth Gibbon, I worked quite closely on this article, and I was very comfortable with natural rhythm rules rule our bodies and dictate the best times for a range of activities, and here's our countdown. Great, fantastic. Not quite so comfortable with 10 a.m., have a bikini wax. Or an injection, or a visit to the dentist. Basically anything with an ouch factor. Pain intensity is at its lowest between 10 a.m. and 8 and 10 a.m., says Professor Russell Foster. It's not entirely clear why, but it's probably because pain receptors aren't as alert as they are later in the day. I promise you, I never actually said that, Peter. I was probably most profoundly uncomfortable with the final statement, which is, 6:30 p.m. heralds the start of 2.5 hours of sex and booze. So if you're feeling frisky in about 20 minutes' time, you know what's going on. Okay. Well, of course, what this is alluding to is some extraordinary, amazing biology. If we look at our physiology and behaviour at two times of the day, the middle of the day and the middle of the night, we see extraordinary and dynamic changes. Here's an example of the hormone melatonin, which is released from the pineal, and you see that during the day there's no release at all. But in anticipation of dark, melatonin levels start to rise, and in anticipation of dawn, they start to collapse. In the same way, core body temperature shows a really nice rhythm. So from around about 4 to 6 a.m. in the morning, it starts to rise in anticipation of activity, peaking at around about 8 o'clock in the evening and collapsing after that to its low point between 4 and 6 a.m. And in fact, with the Olympics coming up, this is actually rather important because some studies have shown, in swimmers, for example, that you can swim 100 meters 2.7 seconds faster here than you can here. Now, 2.7 seconds doesn't sound like a lot, but it's the difference between coming first and last in an Olympic swimming competition. So although it doesn't sound like much, it's a good illustration of the fact that most of the time we're sort of vaguely unaware of these internal rhythms. But when you push physiology to the edge, these constant adjustments really kick in. In fact, I should also add, it's this drop in core body temperature that's also quite important in initiating sleep. If we think of alertness and cognitive performance, reasonably stable during the day, but after around about 8, 9 o'clock in the evening, it drops to really quite low levels. And not our work, but studies have shown that at around about 4 to 6 a.m. in the morning, your ability to perform cognitive tasks is as impaired as if you consume sufficient alcohol to make you legally drunk. So if you're driving a car at 4 to 6 a.m., then your ability to drive that car is as bad as if you got into the car legally drunk. So please don't. And we could go on and on and on. And you see every aspect of our physiology and behaviour is constantly being adjusted by this internal day, this day within. And what it's doing, of course, is our biology is highly dynamic and it's fine-tuned to the varying demands of activity and rest. And let me emphasise again, these rhythms will continue under constant conditions. So how do they originate? And of course we look into the brain and we flip the brain on its back here. So this is the pituitary gland. These are the optic nerves coming in and fusing. And if we look just above this point here, and you can see a section, here's where the optic nerves fuse. Here's the optic chiasm. You have these two structures called the suprachiasmatic nuclei, or the SCN. And this provides the origin of that day within. Okay, so we've got this clock, as it were, ticking away within the brain, consisting of, in humans, perhaps as many as 50,000 cells. Each individual neuron is capable of generating a 24-hour oscillation in electrical activity, and when all coupled together, you get that collective rhythmic output from these paired structures here. So that's the primary clock within the brain, but of course it's absolutely no use whatsoever unless internal time is set with respect to external time. And of course the classic mismatch between internal time and external time is jet lag. You get over jet lag primarily because you're exposed to the light-dark cycle in the new time zone, detected by receptors within the eye, which then set these cells, these molecular oscillators, individual cells within the SCN. In turn, the eye, talking to the clock then coordinates the rhythmic activity of all the physiology and behaviour we're talking about. Now, what's been discovered over the past few years is that the molecular mechanisms in these individual cells in the SCN seem to occur in basically every cell in the body. So it's not that the SCN is forcing and imposing a 24-hour rhythm on the rest of our biology. It's actually coordinating the rhythmic activity of all these peripheral clocks. So you have this extraordinary, beautiful circadian system. Now, what I need to show you is we're going to see a lot of examples of this. These rhythms in output are often depicted in the following schematic, an actigram. So we have days going down here. This is happens to be a wake-sleep cycle. This is when the individual is awake, and this is when they're asleep. So you'll see lots of depictions like this. Okay, so the first point to make, we sort of basically made it already, is if you destroy this region of the brain, then overt 24-hour rhythms are lost. You've lost this central organizing structure. Individual SCN neurons, cells within the periphery, may well be ticking away for a bit, but essentially they've lost their principal coordinator. Now, if you have no eye, then of course the clock is still ticking, but it's no longer aligned to the light-dark cycle, the natural day. And in humans, the body clock is slightly longer than 24 hours. So if we had no eyes, or we were exposed to constant darkness, then our rhythm would get later and later. We get up later and later and later each day. And under those circumstances, the clock is said to be free-running. Okay. Now, what you might predict is if you had no eyes, or if we went down to a dim, dark cave, constant light, constant temperature, then all these rhythms that we've been talking about would drift in the same coordinated pattern. And the key thing is that they don't. They drift apart. So what happens is that the clock here is at a slightly different time to the clock in different structures in the brain, the heart, the gut, the liver. So you have this essentially temporal smear. And that's why jet lag is so ghastly. It's not that you're simply 5 hours shifted from New York time to Cambridge time. It's that all of our internal physiology is just sort of smeared. And so what happens, light is doing two things. Of course, it's setting internal time with respect to external time, but it's also via the SCN providing a cue for all those different rhythmic processes to align appropriately to each other. And that's really the processes, the input side of this whole process I want to talk about next. Everybody clear? Is that all? Everybody happy? Any burning questions? Nope. Good. Right. Let's move on. So this receptor in the eye that I've been sort of prattling on about. So the question that we started asking at the beginning of the 90s was, how does the eye regulate internal time? And those who are not familiar with looking at eyes and their structure, just let me orientate you. Here's a section through the eye. And these, and this is the retina, and this represents the rods and the cones. The rods being sort of those dim light vision receptors, whereas the cones providing our color vision and our contrast perception. So this is the outer retina. And you'll see this image quite a lot in the rest of the presentation. Here's the inner retina, which was traditionally thought and does provide the initial first stages of neural processing to try and generate an image from these glorious rod and cone photoreceptors. And so why were we asking this question? Isn't it kind of obvious? These are the rods and cones therefore must be the receptors regulating internal time. But we felt uncomfortable with that assumption for the following reasons. What we knew about is that the way that the circadian system, the clock, and the visual system processes light information is fundamentally different. So we know that the circadian system sums light information over the entire environment. It grabs light from an entire 180 degrees arc. It doesn't matter where the light is coming from, it counts as light. And of course, if you think about it, vision is the exact opposite. What the visual system has to do is grab light in a particular region of space. It focuses onto those rod and cone receptors, and then there's extraordinary mapping to the visual cortex here. So this is brightness, irradiance detection, whereas this is specific capture of light from a region of space or radiance. So that's a big, big difference. The circadian system is insensitive to dim light, so light at which you could comfortably read by will not effectively shift the clock. It might modulate it, but it really isn't good at shifting the clock. You need bright light, and we'll come on to that a bit later on. Whereas, of course, the visual system is ultra-sensitive to dim light. The circadian system is insensitive to short-duration light stimuli, so a flash of lightning, which is some 50 times brighter than sunlight, would not shift the clock. Whereas, of course, the visual system is only sensitive to short-duration light stimuli. That's how it works. And finally, the circadian system can count photons over very long periods of time. So if you give the same amount of light, expanded out to 45 minutes or squeezed into 5 minutes, the clock thinks it's basically the same thing. Whereas the visual system is working in the millisecond, a fraction of a second range. So these are very, very different. And it wasn't clear how the visual cells could extract this sort of irradiance, brightness, dawn, dusk information from the environment. And that's really why we started to work on this whole topic. And the first approach was a very pragmatic one. We used mutant mice, mice in which the classical visual cells had degenerated as a result of some sort of genetic lesion. And one we spent a lot of time working on was the RD mouse. If you have two defective copies of the gene, then you've lost your rods and most of your cones. A significant number of cones, however, remain in these mice, and that's important for the discussion later on. These animals are classically visually blind. So these are the first animals we looked at. And what you can do is you can pop a mouse into a running wheel like this, connect the running wheel to a computer, and you can get these depictions of activity. So here's the light-dark cycle, and we see that under a light-dark cycle, nocturnal animal, it's running when the lights are off on every day, and it's broadly quiet during the day, during the light phase. Plunge the animal into darkness. Now, the mouse body clock, remember the human one is slightly longer, the mouse one is slightly shorter, so it will start its activity a little bit earlier and earlier and earlier each day. But what you can do is that in the middle of the dark, shortly after the animal starts its running, you can give it a single 15-minute pulse of light, and the next day, it'll get up later. It shows a shift in the phase of the rhythm. So what you've got is a wonderfully elegant and simple behavioural assay. Will the mouse entrain, and will it shift in response to light? And so that's what we did. We took those RD mice, we put them in running wheels, and these are the data. So we've got brightness along this axis, and we've got the size of the shift along this axis here. Normal animal, perfectly normal retina. One copy of the defective gene, basically a normal retina. Two copies of the defective gene, lost your rods, most of your cones, ghastly-looking retina, visually blind. But when we overlaid these irradiance response curves, they were statistically indistinguishable. And that told us something really exciting is happening. Because normal circadian responses to light in an animal that was visually blind. And let me stress, if you stop light getting to the eyes in these animals, then all responses to light cease. So it's something in the eye. So what we showed with these early experiments is that a mouse can be visually blind, but not circadian blind. And I was young. This is 1991. And so I went on to say, well, could there be an uncharacterized photoreceptor within the eye, different from the rods and cones? Now, the avalanche of bile that was then thrown at us after saying something like that is summarized in the next slide. Vision neuroscientists at the time were deeply suspicious of these data. And I suppose they had a point. We've studied the eye for 150 years, quite sensibly. And what we were saying is maybe there's another receptor different from the rods and cones within the eye. And the debate went on. They countered with, well, the circadian system can probably maintain normal photosensitivity with reduced numbers of rods and cones. And they were right. I would give endless seminars, and somebody at the back would always say, hang on, you haven't lost all the rods and cones. It's a very simple task. You only need a few to do it. There were very good theoretical reasons why that couldn't have been the case. However, what these actually semi-reasonable criticisms prompted us to do was, of course, better experiments. So what we did was take the rodless naturally occurring mutant and cross it with a transgenic animal whereby all of the cones had been eliminated. And so in the process, we could take away all of the rods and cones. And in these two papers, we were then able to show some convincing data. And the data can be summarized here. Again, looking at the circadian system, entrainment, phase shifting, brightness increasing along here, size of the shift along here. This is a mouse with no rods and cones at all, and here's the wild type. Statistically no different. So really very exciting data. What we have been able to show with these data is that the rodless coneless mouse allowed us to conclude that there is a third ocular photoreceptor. It must exist within the mammalian eye. And it provided a conceptual framework then to address what these photoreceptors might be and what else they might do. And that's what I'd like to move on to next. What are they? Well, take away the rods and cones, you have a limited number of cells to choose from. Was it bipolar cells, horizontal cells, or ganglion cells? Now, the year before we published the mouse work, we'd actually published a paper on fish, which we discovered a gene in fish which formed a light-sensitive molecule, and it was turning up in horizontal cells and ganglion cells. So we thought, well, maybe the mice, maybe the mammalian situation is the same. Maybe it's horizontal cells or ganglion cells. And it was actually very useful because we were still facing huge opposition to the whole idea of another receptor in the eye. And our work in fish had shown, well, actually, we have evidence for it. So it's not such a crazy idea. We've shown it in fish before the mammals. Okay, what we now know is that in the absence of the rods and cones, it's ganglion cells. A small number of ganglion cells, about 1 in every 100, is directly light sensitive. And these are called photosensitive retinal ganglion cells. And this was shown basically by three groups. David Burson, working on the rat, using classical electrophysiological techniques, whereby he pharmacologically isolated the rods and cones from the rest of the retina and got light responses from ganglion cells. We, at the same time, were working on the rodless coneless mouse and used calcium imaging techniques, and I'll give you some sense of what we did in a moment. And then Dennis Dacey did some beautiful work on the macaque, again using classical electrophysiological techniques, showing that a small number of these ganglion cells are directly light sensitive. Let me just show you what we did. And this is work. At that time, it was Sum Sakaran. She was a postdoc in our group, and now she's a lecturer at Oxford, and the work was led by Mark Hankins in the team. So what we could do is take the rodless coneless retina, stick it in a dish, load it up with calcium-sensitive dyes, and then just simply turn light on it. And so, I need to go over here. So what we could show, and here we see these grey-black blobs are these ganglion cells. Let's just hope the movie works. Yep, so background levels of calcium, nothing's going on. You'll see at the moment, the lights will go on. Now? Yes. Look at the latency. Several seconds go by and then bang. These individual ganglion cells are responding to light. It's a wonderful technique because you can not only look at lots and lots of ganglion cells at the same time, but also look at the direct light responses of individual ganglion cells. So yes, ganglion cells are directly light sensitive, a subset of them, small number. But what this technique also allowed us to do, and I have to say we were very surprised by it, is that the responses from these ganglion cells are not all the same. So there's three different types. When the lights are on, and this is about a minute of light exposure, you see that the cell responds to light throughout that whole period. Others stop responding while the lights are on. And yet a third group, after a minute of light exposure, they will continue signaling that they've seen light for 20 minutes after. So this is not a simple system. And in fact, the work which I don't have time to go into is now trying to understand the basis for this heterogeneity of responses in these ganglion cells. Another glorious property of these cells is illustrated here. So what we're doing is we're increasing the brightness of the 1 minute stimulus here, and then looking at the response. You see, no response at this brightness, and a big response here. But let's look at this non-responding cell at 10 to the 12, and just keep the lights on. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. After 5 minutes, the cell then responds to light. So the sorts of properties we were talking about earlier, this ability to integrate light over very long time periods, can actually be observed in individual neurons in a dish. Okay, so very interesting cells, utterly different from the properties of the rods and cones. So, everybody happy? Yes? I'm sorry? Great question. Why do we use blue light? And that's going to be answered next. Fantastic. Okay, in fact, what is the light-sensitive photopigment? I promise you that we hadn't worked this out beforehand. So, bit of background. What's remarkable, I think, about the animal lineage in general is that, in broad terms, the light-sensitive molecules in a whole range of different photoreceptors, whether you're a fly, whether you're a third eye of a reptile, whether you're an ostrich, the basic biochemistry has been conserved. And what you see are two bits to the light-sensitive molecule, a protein called an opsin. And what you see here is a protein, and it forms sort of like a cage with seven bars forming this cage. And in the middle of this cage, it traps a very specific form of vitamin A, not C, sorry about that, vitamin A, called retinal. And what happens is that the first stage of light detection is the absorption of a photon by this vitamin A. It straightens out. This changes these protein bars, and that ultimately triggers some interaction and a change in the membrane potential of the cell. So it's broadly conserved biochemistry. And let me just also illustrate the fact that these pigments, these opsin vitamin A pigments, may absorb in the blue part of the spectrum, green, yellow, or red. But look at the shape of the curve. It's the same in every case. And that's really important, because if you have a response that can be described by a curve like that, you know you're dealing with a molecule that is made of an opsin and a vitamin A. So what you can do is use behavior to identify an opsin vitamin A photopigment. You can work out which wavelengths, which colors of light are the most effective at stimulating your response, and will it be described by a curve like that? And if it is, you know you've got this. And that's what we did. So, this is background again. These are the known pigments in the mouse eye, an ultraviolet receptor. We've just got some nice data coming out on those really weird cells. A rod receptor and a cone receptor here. Just remember these numbers here. So what we went on and did was to take the rodless, coneless mouse, give it a pulse of light, look at the shift in the behavior, and we changed the color and the intensity of that light. And what we got was a beautiful fit to an opsin vitamin A pigment, but look where the peak is. It's at 480 nanometers. It is not where the known UV, rod, or cone receptors were. And that told us immediately we were dealing with a fourth opsin photopigment within the mouse eye. And we now know that that special molecule is called melanopsin. Now, melanopsin was discovered not by our lab, it was discovered by Iggy Proventio. Now, Iggy Proventio was my PhD student in the University of Virginia, when he was involved in some of those early studies I talked about in the RD mouse. When he left the lab, he said, "I'm never going to work on mice again. They're smelly, they bite me, they're expensive, I just hate them. I'm going to work on a really lovely organism like the African clawed toad." Now, I don't know if you know what the African clawed toad, but it's basically the animal equivalent of a bad cold. It's a large blob of green snot. And he wanted to work on the African clawed toad because he was interested in their skin. The skin of these amphibians is directly light sensitive. They have melanophores, which are directly light sensitive. And he wanted to work out the mechanism. And he isolated from these melanophores an opsin vitamin A pigment, and he called it melanopsin from the melanophores. Nothing to do with melatonin, which is endlessly confusing. Being a bright lad, he then discovered that melanopsin wasn't just restricted to the amphibians, but the gene was turning up across, in fact, all vertebrates. And what he and we and other groups around the world then were able to show is that those light-sensitive cells that we'd shown, and here's one here, also contain melanopsin. And this is a nice image because you see here, these are the rod outer segments. And in a slightly different plane of focus, this represents one of those melanopsin photosensitive ganglion cells. This is a close-up of one of these cells, and you see that this extraordinary broad, they're large cells with a big branching pattern. And this, oh yes. And you can see what happens is that the field basically overlaps. And so what you've got is essentially a photosensitive net that encompasses most of the arc of the eye. Now, these fibres are confined in a fairly narrow plane, and I'm hoping that the next image will illustrate that. This is some 3D reconstruction we've been doing on these cells. And you see that as you twist them and you turn them horizontally, you see that there's a very narrow plane of focus of this sort of net. And what we're working on is the dynamics of how these various light-sensitive ganglion cells, in fact, interact. Okay, we said the light-sensitive molecule was melanopsin. How do we show that? Well, again, lots of different ways, but the approach I'm going to show you is to turn the gene off, to genetically ablate the melanopsin gene in those mice. So, the first experiment is the easy one, because we took away the rods and the cones, and we took away melanopsin, and the result was absolutely no ability to either entrain to a light-dark cycle or shift the clock. No entrainment, no shifting responses to light. And I'd like to emphasize this is a collaboration between my group and Qinghui Yao, led by Sama Hatta in King's lab and Rob Lucas, who is in my group. Okay, so rods, cones, melanopsin, ganglion cells can account for all light responses in the eye. Fantastic. But bit more complicated than we thought. What happens if we only remove the melanopsin and leave the rods and cones there? What we predicted from those early experiments, remember, take away all the rods and cones, perfectly normal regulation of the clock. So we assume, take away melanopsin, you'd lose the ability to regulate the clock completely. That's not what happened. These mice could entrain, and they could phase shift. They didn't do it very well. In fact, the responses were reduced by about half. But what these data showed is that the rods and cones can partially compensate for the loss of melanopsin. And so our clear sort of division with melanopsin photosensitive ganglion cells and the rods and cones really doing parallel things wasn't quite right. It's very clear now that these rods and cones talk to the photosensitive ganglion cells. So there's an important interaction between all three photoreceptors. In the absence of melanopsin, the rods and cones can partially compensate for their loss. And in fact, a big chunk of what we're doing and other labs around the world is to look at that interaction. Okay, before we move on, any other burning questions? Are we all happy? Okie dokie. You sure? Oh, yes, sorry, yeah. Yeah. Okay, can we talk about that later? Because, in fact, it's a really interesting question. And just very briefly, the paper that's coming out shows that those ultraviolet cones are incredibly important to the circadian system. We basically dismissed them. We thought they weren't playing a role at all. As it turns out, they may be almost as important as the melanopsin ganglion cells. But that's a really great but a story that's kind of complicated. But thank you very much. It's a good question. Okay, multiple and diverse functions. As I said, what we thought about is a cell that regulates the body clock. We now know that these photosensitive ganglion cells do much more than regulate the circadian system. We know, of course, that these ganglion cells have direct projections to the master pacemaker, the SCN, within the hypothalamus. But work from our lab, but most notably Sama Hatta, has shown that actually these melanopsin ganglion cells project to a vast array of different structures within the hypothalamus and the thalamus. Much of the ancient brain gets a direct light input from these cells. What we've been doing is trying to find out what the consequences of this is. Here's, of course, the SCN and the regulation of circadian behavior. But the OPN, the olivary pretector nuclei, are intimately associated with pupil constriction. And I'll show you some data for that in a moment. And the ventrolateral preoptic nuclei, critically important in the regulation of sleep and arousal systems. And I'll talk about that very briefly. Let's start with the pupil. And this is a great collaboration with Ron Douglas. And he taught Rob and I how to do these pupil studies in mice. Basically, here's a mouse sitting in the dark. The lights are turned on, and you see a lovely constriction of the pupil. It's been filmed with infrared cameras. Increase the brightness, increase the level of constriction. So what happens if you take away the rods and the cones? To our, I suppose, surprise, you need more light, but you can fully constrict your pupil in the absence of the rods and cones. So what we think is going on in pupil constriction, at least in the mouse and maybe humans, is that there's a two-stage event. You go from a dim lecture theatre like this outside. The rods and cones provide the immediate constriction. But if you want to maintain pupil constriction under sustained bright light conditions, that's when your brightness detector kicks in. And so you have this two-stage process in pupil constriction. What about this structure here, the velpo? And the regulation of sleep. Again, a little bit of background. If we go into the hypothalamus and we enlarge this area here, you see the ventrolateral preoptic nuclei, which is illustrated here. And this has been well defined by a chap called Cliff Saper from Harvard. And what Cliff has shown, and a few other groups around the world, is that this is an incredibly important structure in regulating levels of arousal and sleep. It's connected to these structures here. Tuberomammillary nuclei, raphe, locus coeruleus, lateral dorsal tegmentum. And what these structures do is feed forward, bathe our cortex with neurotransmitters that keep us awake. Turn the velpo on, and it turns all of these structures off. So that's why Cliff calls it a sleep switch. Okay, turn that on, you turn this off, and you induce sleep. What Cliff showed in the rat, and we showed in the mouse, is that the retina has a very nice projection to the ventrolateral preoptic nuclei. Furthermore, we know that light has a big effect on regulating levels of arousal. If you think of a diurnal mammal such as ourselves, you dim the lights during the wake phase, you promote sleep, you reduce the latency to sleep. And actually, this is a well-described phenomenon, and knowing this is a great solace to people who spend their times lecturing to undergraduates. Because when you look around the auditorium and you see them all nodding off, you know it's nothing to do with the content of the lecture, it's just that they're sitting under dim light conditions. Of course, that's for us, a diurnal mammal. What about a nocturnal species? Well, of course, it's the reverse. Turn the lights on in the middle of their active phase, and one should induce sleep. And that's sort of a little bit of studies on that, but really not very much. So we started to explore this response in our mice. The control was, of course, you put the mouse under a light-dark cycle, turn the lights on, and you induce sleep. Yes, fantastic. Take away the rods and cones, and beautiful induction of sleep. Almost no effect of losing the rods and cones, whatever, on the ability of inducing sleep in these mice. So the photosensitive ganglion cells strongly implicated. Next experiment, kind of obvious. What happens when just the melanopsin gene is knocked out in these melanopsin knockout animals? Will it be like the circadian system, where they can still do it, but not quite as well? Or will you eliminate it completely? What we expected was something like the circadian system. They'll probably be able to do it broadly. But what we found was, here's the control, turn the lights on, induce sleep. No melanopsin, no sleep. So unlike the circadian system, these melanopsin ganglion cells are really important in the light regulation of sleep. And I don't have time to show you the data, but also in humans, the reversal, turn lights on, increase the amount of light during the sleep phase, and you enormously increase arousal, and it's likely to be those photosensitive ganglion cells as well. Not the data aren't quite as clear, but the assumption is there. Okay, so what we've got is that these photosensitive ganglion cells provide a dominant input to the regulation of the acute arousal of sleep mechanisms. Okay, so we've talked about all of this mouse stuff. Let's go from mouse models to humans. Do humans lacking rods and cones also retain non-image-forming responses to light? And this is a study I really like because it's one of those rare acts of sanity in science where I was at a meeting reporting some of our data from a little old lady we studied who had no rods and cones, and Steve Lockley from Harvard was also reporting their data from a little old man with no rods and cones. Now, what you'd normally do is you'd rush back to your lab and you'd try and publish first. And what we did, quite sanely, was put the two individual case studies together because they complemented each other. The person who led our work was Farhan Zahidi, and I'll talk about our data predominantly. And he was the PhD student of Merrick Moseley, who's now at City University. So what Farhan did, I just happened to be at a seminar where Farhan was reporting his results from an 88-year-old lady who had a massive rod cone dystrophy. She'd essentially lost her rods and cones. The gene is still unknown. It's a massive defect, and she had no perception for 50 years. Her retina, this is a normal retina, what it should look like, was completely smashed to bits. And when you do optical coherence tomography, which is essentially an optical slice through the eye, all the rods and cones seem to have been completely ablated in this individual. So I asked Farhan, you know, my question at the end was, so do you know if this lady has a normal sleep-wake pattern? He said, well, I don't know, I'm an ophthalmologist, why would I ask such a stupid question? He then got on the phone and said to SC, do you sleep all right? And she said, yes, dear, absolutely fine. You know, go to bed basically at the same time every night. So that was kind of interesting. Katerina Wolf, who does a lot of our human circadian work in the lab, then studied her specifically, and these are her data, so here's time along here, this is her activity, this is the middle of the night. And you see, for an 88-year-old lady, this is actually pretty good. She's not drifting in the pattern that you might expect if she had no light input to the clock. So she's entrained. And this, by comparison, shows a younger, more robust pattern from the Harvard group. Again, a beautiful rest activity cycle, and in fact, the hormonal peak of melatonin is exactly where it should be in the middle of the dark phase. So she entrained. The next question that I asked Farhan was, all right, well, does she show a pupil response, thinking of the mouse data? And he said, well, of course not, because that's how we ophthalmologists define blindness. I shouldn't do that. We shine a light in the eye, and we look for a pupil constriction. And I said, okay, but remember, these are sluggish cells. They need a lot of light for sustained periods. Just leave the torch there for a bit. And so he did, and of course, she showed a beautiful pupil constriction. And what's more, when he looked at the spectral response, which is the colour of light to which this response was maximally sensitive, it was at 481 in the blue part of the spectrum, not corresponding to the known photoreceptor classes in the human eye. So really very pleasing data showing that humans are indeed like mice. And one can use a mouse model to look at human phenotypes, and as I'll show you in a moment, human phenotypes also to inform studies in mice. That was the confirmative bit of the data. The nice bit of the data is illustrated here. We asked, or Farhan asked SC, are you aware of light at any level? And she said, no, I have no perception of light at all, and I haven't had for 50 years. And we said, well, would you mind taking part in the following set of experiments? Which is to be exposed to a 10-second episode. Light off for 5 seconds, sound pulse, light off for 5 seconds, and you randomize this, and you basically force the individual to say, was the light on the first episode or the second episode? And she said, look, I can't do this. I have no perception of light. We said, okay, but just imagine if you could, just yeah, when I say forced, I mean, it's not that we put our arm behind her back. I mean, we just sort of asked her gently if she would take part in these experiments. A statistical significance would be if she got it 15 out of 20 times. And remarkably, she got it 20 out of 20 times. When asked, when forced, she knew when the lights were on subconsciously every time. So this was really exciting because it looked as though those photosensitive ganglion cells are actually involved in our subconscious light detection. But of course, we were back where we were with the original RD data. Maybe it's just a few rods and cones left allowing her to perform this task. So what do? An action spectrum. We looked at the spectral response. Slightly differently this time. We changed the wavelength of the stimulus here, and it was at threshold levels, just that could be detected. And what this shows is that it's only at 480 nanometers where these melanopsin ganglion cells that she can do it reliably above chance, suggesting that these ganglion cells really are part of our subconscious awareness of light. Okay, let me now go to the last part, which is essentially the clinical application. Before I go forward, any burning questions? All happy? Yep. Right, ophthalmology. So what we can extract so far from all these mouse data and the human studies is that visual blindness need not result in loss of all light detection by the eye. And I've been mean to my ophthalmological colleagues. It's not something that they will have ever been taught. It's not part of their training. It's only really just come online. And really, sleep and 24-hour rhythm abnormalities are simply ignored by the clinical ophthalmology profession. And when I moved to Oxford 7 years ago, one of the exciting things was to work with my clinical colleagues in the Oxford Eye Hospital, and Susan Downes is the person I've been collaborating most actively with. So my department, the Nuffield Laboratory of Ophthalmology, is now working very closely with the Oxford Eye Hospital. Okay. So, what's the impact of ocular disease on human sleep-wake biology? Very simple question. And you can measure it terribly easily. You've got these little devices to measure activity. You've got questionnaires. And you can ask people to collect their urine over 48 hours. Very easy. You just pee into a bottle, write the time, stick it in the fridge. Well, you don't even have to stick it in the fridge. You can put it in a cool place. Katerina then cycles around Oxford in her bicycle with a big wicker basket in front of it, loads up the urine samples and cycles back. And what you can do is then get glorious rest activity profiles. So here's the rest activity profile. This individual was going to bed a little bit late here and getting up a little bit late, but broadly a nice stable profile, and these are the peaks in melatonin. So really easy, long-term, robust assays in these individuals. So, the big question is, what's going on in eye disease generally? Can we get some evidence-based data? And the first area was in cataracts, largely because we can get large numbers of individuals, and cataracts represent a potentially very important problem for the regulation of the clock. Let me explain why. Of course, the yellowing and thickening of the lens obscures the amount of light reaching the eye. And what's really interesting is that abnormalities in sleep timing are a common feature in the elderly population. You're reducing, of course, vision, but you're also reducing the amount of light available to these photosensitive ganglion cells. Cataracts, aging lenses will not only attenuate visual capabilities, but also the ability to regulate the clock. So that's the first problem. But we're also dealing with a relatively aged population, and they are also vulnerable for the following reason. This is the most depressing slide I'm going to show you, which is going into a nursing home at 20 past 2 in the afternoon and looking around, and you see that the amount of light that these individuals are exposed to is around about 20 lux. Now, let me just put that level of light into context. For the robust regulation of the clock, you need 1,000 to 2,000 lux. On a cloudy day, you've got 10,000 lux, and even on a bright, sunny day in the UK, you'll be about 100,000 lux. These individuals are sort of in this range here, and I should say that typical office lighting is usually around about 400 lux. It's significantly lower than this sort of bright light you need to regulate the clock. We spend most of our lives in dim, dark caves, but we do get out a bit, and we do experience natural light, which allows us to entrain. In the nursing home environment, people don't get out much. And so this is what they're experiencing for their daylight. So they're not getting a very robust light-dark signal in the first place. Put cataracts on the top of that, and you have real problems. Okay, so this is a study that's been led by Fiona Cuthbertson, our clinical colleague, and supervised by Susan Downes, who's the consultant ophthalmologist in the Oxford Eye Hospital. Stuart, Katerina, big inputs. We're looking at the effects of clear lenses and yellow lenses being implanted, and I'll explain why in a moment. Okay, so let's pop in a clear lens, remove the cataracts, And we have been able to study, we're in the process of studying over 1,000 people. We've got data for 500 all the way through. We're looking at the impact of sleep-wake timing before, 1 month after, 6 months and 12 months after the cataract surgery. And what's really exciting, because the data are beautifully clear, is that there's sustained, highly significant in sleep and sleep timing after surgery. So it is, yes, genuinely having an impact upon the quality of life in these of these individuals, and we can show that very clearly. That's the clear lenses. What about these yellow lenses, which are also being used these days? Now, why use a yellow lens? Because a yellow filter will reduce the amount of blue light reaching the eye. And there's an idea that blue light will enhance age-related macular degeneration. So the thought is, let's pop a yellow lens in, which reduces the amount of blue light, reducing the vulnerability for age-related macular degeneration. The data for that, I have to say, are not that good. But of course, by using a yellow filter, you're going to reduce the amount of light, potentially, for those blue light-sensitive, photosensitive ganglion cells. And I must stress, these data are emerging. We're doing exactly the same thing for the yellow lenses that we're doing for the clear lenses, but there's a strong hint that the yellow lenses are not as good as clear lenses for sleep stabilization. So there might be very good reasons in terms of sleep-wake circadian biology for using a clear versus a yellow lens. But watch this space. It's data that's emerging. Also data that's emerging is, well, what about other ocular diseases that affect the retina? Very much work in progress, but let me give you a sense of where we're going with it. Individuals with the diseases of the inner retina resulting in retinal ganglion cell death and optic nerve degeneration are at massive risk of circadian rhythm and sleep disruption. If you've lost this bit of the eye, as you have in conditions like glaucoma, you've lost those ganglion cells. Even though the rods and cones may be okay, you've got no way that the rods and cones can communicate with the brain, and indeed you've lost those photosensitive ganglion cells. So what we've got here is a really important issue. It's very likely that such individuals would benefit from treatments that consolidate sleep. Is that part of routine practice in ophthalmology? No. Nobody in ophthalmology departments around the world, or very few, are actually taking this into consideration. What about the other end of the problem? Let's lose our rods and cones. And of course, losing rods and cones and visual blindness, as in age-related macular degeneration, Leber's congenital amaurosis, or choroideremia, massive cause of blindness in the UK and around the world. But let's just think about it for a moment. Visual blindness need not mean complete blindness. If a blind individual, such as age-related macular degeneration, shows a bright light-dependent pupil constriction, then they should be encouraged, where possible, to expose their eyes to sufficient daytime light to maintain normal circadian training. So if you're visually blind, your ophthalmologist will not tell you to try and make sure you're getting enough light exposure to stabilize your clock. And in fact, for aesthetic reasons rather than clinical reasons, many people will cover up their eyes using dark glasses to block out any sort of visual representation of their eyes because it's unpleasant to other people. So we've got to take that very, very seriously. I suppose where I'm going with all this is the three critical points. The discovery of a third photoreceptor system within the human eye argues that the clinical diagnosis of complete blindness should assess the state of both the rod cone and these photosensitive ganglion cell systems. We now appreciate that an eye loss will plunge individuals into a world that lacks both vision and a proper sense of time. If you think about it for just one moment, what your ophthalmologist may explain to you what it's like to go visually blind, but they won't explain what it's like to have unremitting jet lag for the rest of your life. And something could be done about that. And of course, what I'm trying to say is that clinical guidelines must incorporate information relating to both the visual system and these photosensitive ganglion cell photoreceptors. And that's what we're trying to do and develop those guidelines in Oxford. Okay, we've almost done with 5 minutes to spare. What about that? So what I've tried to do is give you some sense of the importance of body clocks and internal time, and a bit of the mechanisms. And in the process of asking really quite naive, simplistic questions, how is the body clock regulated by light, we've tumbled across a new photoreceptor system. It turned out to be based upon a small number of directly light-sensitive ganglion cells that use the photopigment melanopsin, which is a blue light-sensing pigment. we now know that these photosensitive ganglion cells are doing a lot more than just regulating the circadian system. We talked about pupil constriction, we talked about sleep regulation, and there's a whole host of other things that they're doing as well. Really amazing. We talked about the fact that, broadly speaking, the work we're finding in mice maps beautifully onto the human condition, and that we need to be deeply sensitive to the role of these photosensitive ganglion cells in the clinical realm, develop genuine evidence-based clinical intervention whereby my clinical colleagues in ophthalmology can advise their patients on not only vision, but also this other aspect of their life, which is the sleep-wake timing. And the final bit I'd just like to touch on, and I don't know if Charlie, are you in the audience? No? Okay, because he said he was going to try and come along to this. Building design is now taking light seriously. The amount of light that you need for regular entrainment is illustrated here. And of course, what we're saying is that these ganglion cells are maximally sensitive to blue light. And Charlie Sharman, actually heard me speak and has now gone away and designed houses and environments which will maximize our light exposure. And so, therefore, entrain our circadian axis. So I put Charlie's vision of the future up on here to end with, because we might all be living in these beautiful glass constructions that Charlie is thinking of building. And with that, thank you for your attention.